Good evening, everyone. My name is Lynn Farrington, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm the curator of printed books in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library here at Penn, as well as the organizer of this lecture series. I want to thank all of you for coming this evening in the last of what has been a stimulating series addressing food policy in the 21st century. As I mentioned in my introduction for our first speaker, Jonathan Bloom, I'm pleased to see that the audience for this series has truly been diverse, coming from both within Penn and from the greater Philadelphia region. American Pie, The Politics of Food in the 21st Century, is sponsored by the Penn Libraries through the Muriel Felser Bodak Public Affairs Fund. Established in 2001 by Gordon S. Bodak College, 1942, in honor of his wife Muriel, this fund generously supports a lecture series on current public affairs. Gordon and Muriel's son, Hanley, has been to a couple of these. I don't know if he's in the audience tonight, but I'd like to extend our thanks to his family for making this series of lectures possible. American Pie is co-sponsored by the School of Veterinary Medicine, the School of Nursing, and the School of Arts and Sciences Nutrition Minor, the Department of History and Sociology of Science, Agustin Urban Nutrition Initiative, part of the Netter Center for Community Partnerships, the Environmental Kitchen at Penn Women's Center, the Penn Vegan Society, and Penn Appetit, the University of Pennsylvania's innovative student-run magazine covering all things food. At the risk of repeating myself for those of you who were at the earlier talks, I want to thank everyone who over these past 2 years has played a role in the discussions about food studies at Penn. Our discussions revealed to me the vibrant but also diffuse nature of this field, which touches on just about every discipline. In an attempt to draw the community together, we have developed a website called Food Studies at Penn, which you can find with a simple Google search. Courses, events, people, and other related information can be found there. We like to think of the library as one of the interdisciplinary centers of the university, so thanks to the Penn Libraries for their support of the series and the larger Food Studies project. Special thanks for their assistance with this series go to Christine Winch in Library Development, who was immediately supportive when I went to her with the idea of this series, to Janet Hassan, who's here tonight, who made suggestions for speakers when I first approached her last year, to Alita Authors, the library's event planner, who helped with many of the details, including tonight's reception, and I want to invite all of you to join us after tonight's lecture for a reception outside the hall. And to Erin McLean, my Drexel intern, who hopes to combine food and librarianship in her career and who was instrumental in developing the publicity for this series. After exploring the vast amount of waste that occurs within the American food system with Jonathan Bloom and issues concerning the global food animal population with Dr. Alan Kelly last week, tonight we turn to the issue of sustainability. Dr. John Eichard is Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Missouri-Columbia. He has very recently moved from Columbia, Missouri to Fairfield, Iowa. At dinner on Sunday evening, when asked why he moved to Fairfield, Iowa, Dr. Eichard told me that in addition to being a diverse small town, which was partially what he was looking for, it's also Fairfield is a place whose mayor was recently named to the nationwide list of 15 green mayors, and the community itself, is making a grassroots effort to become a sustainable community. Dr. Eichard is the author of a number of works, including Crisis and Opportunity, Sustainability in American Agriculture, Sustainable Capitalism, A Matter of Common Sense, Small Farms or Real Farms, Sustaining People Through Agriculture, and A Return to Common Sense. His website, www.johneichert.com, which also contains information on how to get copies of his publications, provides an online version of one of his books, which is called A Revolution of the Middle and the Pursuit of Happiness. It's available also as an audiobook, which you can download and listen to whether you're walking to class or riding to work. His latest title, scheduled for release this May or June, is The Essentials of Sustainability. In this book, he addresses the basic principles and concepts essential to economic sustainability. Dr. Eichard is also working to organize a 4-day summer institute scheduled from May 31st to June 3rd in Fairfield, Iowa this summer. The Institute is titled Transcending Sustainability, Principles and Paradigms for Exploring Deep Sustainability, and it hopes to help people meet the challenges of sustainability and to create a new and better world for the future beyond sustainability. If you're interested in knowing more about this or anything else I've mentioned, please feel free to talk to Dr. Eichert after this talk. With this, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Eichert, who will speak on the future of food. Sustainable agriculture is not optional.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you tonight. I have enjoyed being here the last couple of days and visiting with a couple of classes, visiting with some folks I see here tonight from the broader community that are dealing with hunger issues, going out to Bartram Farm and visiting and seeing what they're having going on there. So I always learn as much or more when I go somewhere than I teach, and I'm thankful for that and thankful for this opportunity to be here. I always take every opportunity I can get to go visit universities, even when I have other speaking engagements in town, and particularly to talk to young people. Because I believe that we're in a time of fundamental change within our society, as I've told the classes that I visited with today. And I think it's not only a burden of the young people to create the future, as it always is, but I think the young people of today are going to live in a fundamentally different world than the world that I've lived in. It's a time of great transition, and we have to be willing to rethink all the way from the most basic concepts of how we think the world works and where we fit within it. And I like to talk to people before they've made up their mind about how they think the world works. I think too many old people are too reluctant to change. They've got too much invested in the old system. I like to come to universities because universities are at least supposed to be places where people keep their minds open and encourage new ideas and encourage new thinking. And so I want to support the universities in that particular role. Now, I will say in the beginning that what I say is what I call my truth. I speak my truth with conviction because I know why I believe what I believe. Now, if your truth is different from my truth, then that's fine with me because I don't think any of us should be so egotistical as to think that only we have the truth. All I ask is that you know why you believe what you believe. And in my opinion, just because some so-called expert said something is not a good enough reason for anybody to believe anything. So I hope you'll accept my truth, and then I'll leave time for conversation where you can speak your truth after mine, and I would encourage you to do so. The title I chose for the paper that I made available on the topic tonight is the Future of Food. Sustainability or sustainable agriculture is not optional. It is an absolute necessity. You know, the American food system has been the envy of the world, so the advocates of our current food system will argue. It's always praised for the abundance and variety of foods that's available in the supermarkets and the franchised restaurants today. But more recently, the American food system has come under increased scrutiny and increased criticism from several points of view. And it's not just about the food safety issues that tend to make the headlines seemingly more frequently as time goes by, or even the diet issues, which are growing in terms of concern. But there's a whole host of concerns. And these are well documented in best-selling books such as Fast Food Nation and Omnivore's Dilemma, which I think should be required reading of every college student and every citizen. It's well documented in documentaries, which I think are increasingly important in our society, such as The Future of Food and Food Incorporated and Fresh the Movie and Broken Limbs. And all of these tell the same basic story of a food system that's empty of everything except calories and it's deceptive and everything from flavoring to the advertising of food. A food system that's basically lacking in economic, ecological, and social integrity. Now, the advocates of our food system today will tell you, well, it's just the working of a free market economy. It's the food system responding to consumer demand of the marketplace. But I can tell you as an economist that our current economy, including our food economy, has essentially none of the fundamental characteristics that have to be there in order for the markets to be responding to the basic needs of consumers today. The variety and quality and quantity of food in the supermarket today is not a reflection of consumer needs or even necessarily consumer preferences, but it's the kind of foods that make the greatest profits for the corporations that are involved in the food system today. The invisible hand that Adam Smith described in his book, Wealth of Nations, has been mangled in the machinery of an evolution, economic evolution of an industrial food system. It no longer has the characteristics that are essential to transform our individual pursuit of self-interest into the greatest common good of society as a whole. And it's not just the market power, the corporate domination of the marketplace. Perhaps more troublesome is the growing corporate power in the political system. And this series is about policy in general. The greatest impacts, the political influence of the corporations are reflected nowhere more prominently than in the policies of the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA. At least for the last three or four decades, and perhaps longer than that, every significant USDA program, they have some programs that differ from this, but every large and significant program has been about promoting the industrialization of agriculture, driven not just by the agribusiness influence, but by the corporate structures in agriculture itself, the large farm organizations such as the Farm Bureau and the commodity organizations that are promoting the industrialization of American agriculture. Even those programs that are there today that were designed to protect the soil and water from pollution and erosion and such things as this have been modified and perverted to serve the corporate interests. For example, if you look at the broader issues of agricultural policy in general, it's transformed, as I'll talk a bit about later, from programs that were designed to support the family farm, as all of the farm bills will say they're supporting, to programs today that basically subsidize crop insurance for large specialized producers to the tune of about 40% of the total cost of the crop insurance that not only ensures the yield of the farmers, but also ensures the price and basically guarantees that large-scale, specialized, standardized agriculture with acres and acres of corn and soybeans and wheat is going to be guaranteed a profit at the expense of the taxpayer today. Well-intended programs were designed to serve good interest and the public interest to begin with have been totally perverted, as in the case of the Environmental Quality Enhancement Program, which was meant to protect water resources from pollution, but millions of dollars have been diverted to subsidizing the construction of large-scale confinement animal feeding operations, which 50 years of history have shown are consistent violators of whatever regulation is put in place and now threaten not only the natural environment, but the public health of people in rural communities and increasingly challenging even the food, the integrity of the food that's even in our grocery store today. As I say, these programs were designed and well-intended to serve the broader public interest, which is the fundamental responsibility or role of public policy. It was supposed to provide good, safe food for everyone by making agriculture more efficient, economically efficient, to make good, wholesome food affordable to everyone so that everyone within society could have enough food to live an active and healthy lifestyle. But through neglect and outright manipulation, it's been turned into something that's fundamentally different. Now, when we talk about industrialization, a lot of people think in terms of industrialization is about the change from an agrarian to a manufacturing society. But that's simply the symptom of industrialization. Industrialization is characterized by a way of thinking. It arises out of sort of a mechanistic way of thinking, but it uses the fundamental strategies of specialization, standardization, consolidation of control. We specialize so that we can do things more efficiently. Division of labor, it's an old concept. So we specialize into individual specialized activities, but then you have to standardize those individual specialized activities so that you can put them all together to produce a coherent product at the end. Now, once you've specialized and standardized, then you can kind of routinize those standardized processes, and you can mechanize and simplify to the point where you can consolidate the management then into larger and larger units where fewer and fewer people make the decisions about how the land, the labor, the capital is used in the production process. And that's the way you achieve what we call economies of scale, a more efficient system from an economic productivity standpoint by specialization, standardization, consolidation. And so the industrialization of agriculture simply, as they would put it, freed up people from farming and allowed the farms to get larger, which meant there were fewer farmers, which freed up people to go to work in the factories and offices and support a manufacturing society. That's the industrialization process. Now, I think I understand kind of the industrialization of agriculture perhaps better than most people, including most economists, because I've lived through it. I've lived through this whole story of how agriculture has been industrialized. You see, when I was growing up, I grew up on a small farm down in southwest Missouri, small family farm. We milked about 20, 25 cows at that time, and we were pretty typical of agriculture all across the country then. It was largely family farms, and most of the food was produced relatively close to home. It was a local, regional food system. But about that time in the late 1950s, whenever I was going away to college for the first time in 1957 is when I started to school at the University of Missouri, the interstate highways were just being built. Agricultural chemicals were just coming onto the marketplace out of the World War II technologies. It was the munitions technologies during World War II that led to cheap nitrogen fertilizer. Pesticides were coming out of chemical warfare technologies. Gas was cheap. When I was growing up, a dollar's worth of gas was 5 gallons. That was just basically standard. So the whole agricultural system was about to change. We were moving from farming as a way of life to farming as a bottom line business. By the early 60s then, whenever I graduated from college, the industrialization of agriculture was well underway. And after 4 years of agricultural economics, I was well indoctrinated in that. I was a great believer. We had to improve the efficiency of agriculture, and I was going to do my part to do it. I went to work for Wilson Packing Company, one of the fourth largest meat packer in the country at that time. Well, the corporate world didn't set with me too well as a farm boy, so I decided I would go back to graduate school at the University of Missouri. I went back to graduate school, which is a land-grant university, which most of the big agricultural colleges are land-grant universities, but they're designed as the people's universities. They're designed to meet the public interest, and the role of the land grants with respect to agriculture was to provide food security for the nation, to make sure that there was adequate food for everyone, to have enough food for their nourishment and an active, healthful lifestyle in good times or in bad, whether in war or in peace. And the strategies that we had used that had been used in the College of Agriculture and USDA up to that time was to make sure that there were enough family farmers out here on the land who were committed to taking care of the land to provide food for people in the long run, and that was the strategy for food security. So I decided, well, if I couldn't be a farmer, my brother spent his whole life on that farm that I grew up on and made a good living there. He's still there and was still milking cows till a few years ago. But if I couldn't be a farmer, then I would at least work with farmers. So I got a degree in agriculture, and even though I did teaching and research, I also always had an extension appointment where I would go out and work with farmers. But by the mid-1960s then, the public mandate for agriculture was already changing when I come back to graduate school. It was moving away from this concept of supporting family farmers who would take care of the land to making agriculture more efficient. We were going to make food abundant, accessible, high-quality, wholesome food to everyone by making it less expensive, which meant that we would make agriculture more efficient, and it didn't matter the means as long as we achieved the end of bringing down agricultural cost of production to make agriculture more efficient, to bring down the cost of food. That was the beginning of what many farmers still refer to as the cheap food policy as far as agriculture is concerned. By the time I had got my PhD in 1970 then, I was totally committed to that concept. I was convinced that that was good for the country, it was good for farmers, because the farmers that were more efficient would make more money. If there was more money, that had to be good for people in rural communities, and it would be good for society. And I spent the first half of my 30-year academic career as a promoter of that vision, that agriculture as a way of life was out of date. It had to be an economic bottom-line business, that if farmers had to specialize, standardize, get larger, get bigger, get out, is what I talked about. And if it's a family farm, then you had to separate the family from the farm. Quality of life is something that you bought with the profits that you made on a farm or in a business or wherever it was. And what they spent their money on wasn't any business of mine as far as I was concerned. I was about helping make farms more efficient. But during what I still refer to as the farm financial crisis of the 1980s, I had to rethink what I had been taught and what I'd been teaching. You see, during the 1970s, the farmers that followed what we so-called experts were saying, it was booming export markets, and we told farmers that you have to get out here and invest in the technologies that will allow you to become more efficient, farm more land, more equipment, more specialized buildings. Farmers borrowed huge amounts of money at record high interest rates. Those of you who remember the time of booming interest rates and inflation and things of that nature. And we said the export market's going to grow indefinitely with the booming global economy. We got into the 1980s. We went into a domestic recession. We went into a global recession. The export markets dried up. Agricultural commodity prices dropped like a rock. Farmers were caught with large debts at record high interest rates that they couldn't repay. By that time, I was a department head at the University of Georgia. I'd gone from North Carolina to Oklahoma State, University of Georgia. Responsibility of my department was to go out and work with these farmers and try to find out some way to help them save the family farm. You see, bankruptcies and foreclosures were rampant. Farm sales were on the TV news every night. Depression, divorce, suicide, several suicides even in the state of Georgia at the time. It was a terrible time for those of us that were involved in working with farmers and sitting across from those farmers trying to figure out how to help them save the farm or at least not take their life, I had to come to the realization that the farmers that were in the biggest problems were the farmers that had been doing what we so-called experts had been telling them to do. Specialize, standardize, consolidate, invest into larger operations. It had come breaking down all around them. I had to come to the realization that the kind of agriculture I'd been taught and what I was teaching, it wasn't good for farmers. It wasn't good for the families. Not only that, but it wasn't good for the people of rural communities that depended upon those families, not just to shop on Main Street, but to be in the churches and the schools and volunteer in the positions within those communities. And then I realized what the focus of sustainability is mostly about, that it wasn't good for the land, that we were farming fence row to fence row. Erosion was rampant. Pollution was rampant. I come to the conclusion there had to be a better way to farm. This was not working. This was not a sustainable agriculture. Thankfully, at about this time, the sustainable agriculture movement was coming onto scene. And the more I learned about that, the more sense it made. Sustainable agriculture to me was kind of like balanced farming, which was an old program of Missouri Extension Program. It was about balancing the need to make a living with taking care of the land and providing for the living for the family. Balancing family and quality of life with conservation and stewardship of the land and then still making an economic living on the farm. So I spent the second half of my academic career pursuing and trying to understand and promoting a sustainable agriculture, as I've continued to do since I retired going on 13 years ago. I was out here working with farmers, but I was working with farmers that cared about the land, that took care of the land, that were committed to caring for them, that cared about their communities, and they cared about families, and it was a quality of life. You see, sustainable agriculture is a part of the larger sustainable development movement, and that's what these people were into. It's about meeting the needs of all people in the current generation, but doing so in a way that leaves equal or better opportunities for those of the future. It's about creating a permanent agriculture, an agriculture that's capable of maintaining its productivity and usefulness to society indefinitely. You see, all economic value, everything that's of use to us, either comes from the land or it comes from society. And if you don't take care of the land, if you don't take care of people, then you can't sustain anything economically, including sustainable agriculture. I spent my 30-year academic career at four different universities. It was a total change in profession for me. I realized I wasn't going to be an administrator anymore after I started challenging the conventional wisdom of the land-grant universities. So I decided to end my career at Missouri, but overall, University of Missouri, I went back there. But overall, I spent 30 years at four different universities, and I eventually came to the conclusion that the land-grant universities and the big agricultural colleges are so ingrained in this industrial paradigm and so under the influence of corporate agribusiness today that they're not going to support sustainability as a true mission. Every university today has basically been forced into having a sustainable agriculture program, but it's a token program. The purpose of those programs is to marginalize and neutralize the sustainability movement, because sustainable agriculture is a threat to industrial agriculture, and it's a threat to the basic large corporations, because it asks the question, how can we meet the needs of the present, but do it in a way that doesn't compromise opportunities for those of the future? And when you ask that question seriously and honestly, the answer is the agriculture we have today is not sustainable. So I decided to retire when I had in 30 years, because I could do so without any penalties. I could have worked another 5 years, another 10 years, and made a lot more money than I'm getting in retirement. But I wanted to pursue what I had come to believe was necessary for the future. It was no longer optional. It was necessary. You know, I've come to the conclusion, and I've only come to this very recently, that the industrialization of agriculture has been an absolute complete failure. It succeeded in doing the first thing that we were talking about doing. It succeeded in making agriculture more efficient and making food cheaper. And so people brag today that the people of the United States only spend less than 10% of their disposable income for food. And they brag about the fact that the American farmer feeds 50 other people or 100 people, other people or 150 other people, depending on who you count as farmers. And it did those things. But it did not provide food security, which was the fundamental purpose of doing it. It did not feed the hungry. We have more people who are food insecure or hungry in the United States today than we had in the 1960s. The latest statistics I could find for 2010 indicated that 15% of the people in the country are classified as food insecure, meaning that they don't know whether they can make it through the month and have enough food. 20% of the children in this country, the richest country in the world with a bountiful agriculture, 20% of our children live in food insecure homes after 50 years of industrialization. And there'd be even more than that if we didn't have generous food stamp programs and various other food assistance programs that weren't there in the 1960s. You see, the problem of food insecurity or hunger is a problem of poverty, a lack of income, and also a lack of the knowledge of how to select food and prepare food for themselves. Most of what we spend for food today, as I'll say later, is not really for the food. It's for processing, transportation, advertising, things that have no nutrition whatsoever. You see, we're at a point also that even the people that can afford to eat food, the food isn't healthful, it isn't nutritious for them. There's one example of that is at the time whenever we reduced the amount of income spent for food, cut it in one half from about 19% down to less than 10%, we've doubled the amount of a percentage of our gross domestic product that we spend on health care. It's now up to 17% of the total GDP goes for health care, nearly twice as much as we spend on food in terms of the GDP or in terms of gross domestic output. You know, it's really no mystery here. The people that have been supporting organic agriculture, who were the people that really started the sustainable agriculture movement to begin with, they've been talking about the relationship between the food system, the way our food's produced, and health for decades. They've been talking about the negative health impacts of agricultural chemicals and more recently on hormones and antibiotics that are used in the livestock industry and more recently about genetically modified organisms and the rising health concerns associated with that whole history. And there's a whole range of consequences as a result or potential consequences as a result of these things. And I'm not talking about these as proof. I'm talking about them as things that are viable hypotheses that we haven't really explored to a great extent, but such things as cancer and heart disease, attention deficit disorder, and a whole host of allergies, and more recently the outbreaks of E. coli and Salmonella and Listeria and a whole host of these things are related directly, at least logically, to the industrialization of the food system. I think the tipping point in terms of public concern may be the epidemic of obesity. Statistics show that 2/3 of the adults and 1/3 of the children are either obese or overweight in this country. And it's getting worse. Since 1970, the number of obesity among adults has more than doubled. Teenagers, it's tripled. And kids, it's increased by fourfold. We've got real problems in this country today. It's not just obesity as being inconvenience or an embarrassment or whatever it is. It's related to a whole host of diseases, diabetes and health disease, heart disease and high blood pressure and several forms of cancer related directly to the to the diet and related with obesity. A Robert Woods Johnson Foundation study called F is in Fat evaluated this and said, in spite of all the government programs and the private programs to fight obesity and to cause people to live healthier lifestyles and choose healthier diets, we're losing the battle. They project that by the year 2020, one-fifth of the total health care cost will be associated in one way or another with obesity. We're already spending, if it continues to go in the direction that's going in terms of total health care cost, we're going to be spending one-third of our total GDP by the year 2040 on health care. Folks, we cannot afford the high cost of cheap food. Changing our food system is no longer an option. It's an absolute necessity. Perhaps the most obvious call for change, or the necessity of change, is the reliance of industrial agriculture on fossil energy. It relies on fossil energy for fuel and fertilizer, particularly nitrogen fertilizer, for mechanization, for transportation. Our food system claims about 20% of the total fossil energy that's used in this country, and about a third of that is actually at the farm level. And the estimates indicate that we're using about 10 calories of fossil energy for every calorie of food energy that we create. And in addition to that, with the growing environmental problems, agriculture contributes at least a 20% amount to the total greenhouse gas problems, because greenhouse gases are basically what you release whenever you use fossil energy. It's those elements that are tied up by the energy, and when you take the energy out of the fossil energy, then you release the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and things back into the atmosphere. And in addition to that, agriculture creates an additional problem because the livestock industry emits large amounts of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, and the tillage of land releases CO2 from the organic matter in the soil. So when we go more and more to industrial agriculture, not here but around the world, then we're creating tremendous environmental problems as we deplete the natural resources, the resources that we have today. We have to fundamentally change not agriculture but society as a whole, because the whole industrial era, including industrial agriculture, was made possible by abundant and cheap fossil energy. You know, first it was the old growth forest. You wouldn't necessarily call it fossil energy, but it had been growing for centuries. But after that, it was the coal that was very near the surface that you could go and dig out with a pick and shovel if you wanted to. And then after that, it was the oil, where you could go out in Oklahoma and Texas and Pennsylvania here, and you could punch a hole 50 feet in the ground or so, and oil would come spurting out of the ground. And so the oil and natural gas and that came with the oil. And that's what fueled the whole industrial era. But the old growth forests are gone. We have to plant trees now and wait for them to grow. And the surface cold is gone. We're blowing the tops off of mountains all across Appalachia, some 500 named mountains. We've blown the tops off them to get to the remaining coal. The remaining oil is deep beneath the ocean floors or remote corners of the world, and the BP oil spill is just a symptom of what we can see a lot more of, and not only that, it's very costly to get it out of the ground. And the natural gas that's left out there, we've discovered this thing called fracking, where we punch tubes down into the ground or punch holes down into the ground and fill it full of poisonous stuff and put it to a high pressure so that it basically fractures the crust of the earth. Who knows what we're doing to the crust of the earth, trying to get at the last remnants of fossil energy. We're not out of fossil energy, but folks, we're out of cheap, abundant fossil energy, and from here on out, there's going to be less of it, and it's going to be more expensive, and every time the economy begins to grow, you're going to see the price of fossil energy go up, and you're going to go right back into a recession or a decline in terms of economic growth. If we look at the only sustainable source of energy is solar energy, but all the sources of solar energy together, whether we're talking about photovoltaic panels or passive solar energy or wind or water, or which are also solar energy, all of those combined are going to be less plentiful and more costly than has the fossil energy that we had during the industrial era. Change in agriculture and elsewhere is not optional. It's an absolute necessity. You know, change is normal and usual. So people say, well, what's different about this? Well, some changes are truly revolutionary. And I would argue that's where we are today. We're in the middle of a revolutionary change, a great transformation within society. If you look back historically, every 200 years or so, we go through those transitions. I think the one we're in today is at least as great as the Industrial Revolution, probably as great as the beginning of science in the late 1600s, maybe even as great as the change from hunting and gathering to agriculture, which came even before that. What drives these great revolutions and what drives these great transformations is when we come to the point where we realize that what we're doing isn't working and it isn't going to work. And when we decide that we get to that point in the great transformations, we have to rethink how the world works and our place within it. And that's where we are today. And when we rethink how the world works and where we fit within it, it basically changes every aspect of life. I would say that people that are born 50 years from now will not be able to imagine the world that we were in today, and the people that are young people today that are old people 50 years from now won't even be able to believe what it was like in the early 2000s. This great transformation has been driven by the basic questions of sustainability. How can we meet the needs of the present without diminishing opportunities for the future? Since I retired in the year 2000, early 2000, I've had an opportunity to speak at about 25, 35 venues a year, as I call them. Sometimes I speak several times at the same place. But I've spent most of those with people that are in the sustainable agriculture movement. Most of them I've gone to. I take whatever opportunities I can. But I spend these with people that I think are share my hope for the future. They realize the challenges are there, but they feel like and they know that there's ways that we can meet those challenges and that we can accept this challenge of creating a sustainable world and a sustainable agriculture, and we can use that to create something that's fundamentally better than we have today. As we talked about the conference, beyond sustainability, these great challenges and these great transformations give us opportunity to move to a fundamentally higher level within human progress, and that's where we are today. People ask me if I'm optimistic. My answer is I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. Hope isn't the same thing as optimism. Hope comes from the realization that something makes sense, regardless of how it comes out. It's something that makes sense. I talk a lot about common sense. What I'm talking about here, I think, to me, makes sense. What these farmers are trying to do out here makes sense. Hope is not the expectation that something is going to be quick or easy, or even that you know that it's going to succeed. But hope comes from knowing in your heart that something better is fundamentally possible. And I know that it's possible to create a better agriculture that's ecologically sound, socially responsible, economically viable over the long run. The people, the farmers that are involved in this, they may call themselves organic farmers or ecological farmers, holistic resource management. They may practice permaculture. They may be practical farmers, innovative farmers, or no particular name at all. But what these farmers share is the knowledge that in order to create a permanent agriculture that can maintain its productivity, it has to be ecologically sound. It has to be socially responsible to be economically viable. And they have to balance the economic, the ecological, and social to achieve long-run sustainability. They realize that we're not just talking about best management strategies to kind of fine-tune the industrial system to reduce its social or negative social and ecological impacts, but we're talking about rethinking the foundational principles and paradigms of agriculture. We're talking about creating an agriculture that's based on the foundational principles of how nature works, that's holistic, that's diverse, that's interdependent, because that's what healthy natural systems are about. That reflects the basic principles of how people relate to each other sustainably in relationships of trust and caring and having the courage. That reflects the realities of economics in terms of economic scarcity being different from intrinsic value. And efficiency as being necessary but not sufficient. And the sovereignty to make our own decisions and accept responsibility. This is rethinking the state of agriculture from its whole foundations. And there's people out there that are succeeding. I talk about the celebrity farmers. I think it's great that we have celebrity farmers now, like celebrity chefs, Will Allen down in Milwaukee in an urban area, or Joel Southerton out in rural Virginia. Those people are in the movies of Fresh and Food Incorporated and in the books of omnivore's dilemma and so on. But what's more important is they're representative of tens of thousands, if not millions, of farmers all scattered around the world who are doing basically the same thing, but just in a less spectacular or less articulate about what they're doing. I know from my experiences there's at least 8 conferences, annual conferences across the country that will draw over 1,200 people a year, and there's a couple of them up to 2,500 and 3,000 people. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture had like 2,000 people here last year. And these are grassroots organizations, and most of these aren't government bureaucrats or people from universities. There are farmers out here that are sharing information with each other and creating a shared sense of hope for the future. There's so many conferences with 500 to 700 people. I can't keep track of them anymore. I used to know what was going on. Every state has some sort of a movement in terms of sustainable agriculture or one kind or another. These people are creating something that's fundamentally different. In these people, I see the hope for the future, not just for agriculture, but everything of any economic value that comes from the earth, it comes from the people. It's just easier to see in agriculture. We're creating a model for a new economy, a new society. The most visible part of the sustainable agriculture movement is probably the local food movement. It's probably the most visible part, with the doubling of farmers markets and CSAs every 10 years. You can look at any 10-year period in USDA statistics, and they're doubling and they're continuing to grow. They're almost everywhere these days. We can see that the local food movement was projected to reach about $10 billion. By 2011, that was a study that was done in 2008. I haven't seen any recent statistic on it. It's still not as big as the organic food movement, which has been the most dynamic and fastest growing segment of the food system now for almost 2 decades, or maybe a full 2 decades by now. You know, combined, the two of them probably still account for maybe 7 to 10% at most of the total food system. But the last statistics on organic, over 10% of the fruits and vegetables in this country were organic now. That's come from practically nothing. You know, these are growth that give us hope for the future. Even more hopeful, the most credible retail studies that are used by Whole Foods and Walmart and all of the other people indicate that a full third of the Americans are looking for something that's fundamentally different than they're finding in the supermarkets and the fast food restaurants today. We just need to find ways to give them access to the food that's out there. The market is far larger than we're able to supply. What they're looking for is food that's not just fresh and healthful and nutritious, but food that has ecological, social, and economic integrity. In this whole movement, folks, there is hope. You know, when you talk about these things, then people have a tendency to say, well, you're just talking about some elitist food movement when you talk about organic and local food problems. How are you going to solve the hunger problem if you're talking about smaller farms, diversified farms, or organic, or that sort of thing? My first response is, we're not going to solve the hunger problem with more cheap food. We've been doing that for 50 years, and it hasn't been working. It's time that we try something else. And then I come back, just start with the realization in this country. As I indicated before, only 20% of what we spend on food is actually for the farm level cost of the food. The rest of it's processing, transportation, advertising, packaging. The rest of it is to make food more convenient. So if you're a low-income consumer, if you have less money, you can't have more of everything or as much of everything. But I would argue that everybody in this country, that at least that's got a job that's on the lower income, can afford the food. They can afford the 20%. You see, if a low-income person is spending 50% of their income on food, 40% of their income is going for processing, transportation, advertising, and in general, people on the lower income scale eat more highly processed, highly packaged foods because they don't have access to the fresh local foods. If we could give low-income people access to fresh local foods that were minimally processed, then they could eat at less expensive by far than they're eating today. But the key thing is they'd have to know which foods to select and how to prepare those foods to make them for their family. So we're not going to solve the hunger problem by make food cheap just by focusing on food. We're going to solve the hunger problem when we really care about whether low-income people have enough food to eat, and we create government programs or other programs or volunteer programs like a lot of these folks here are doing to help people gain access to food and help them select foods that are healthy for them and for their families, and to know how to prepare them and to reorganize the lifestyle so that they have time and have the incentive to prepare them. When we look at the rest of the world, when you talk about hunger in the rest of the world, I would point out the same thing. There's no fewer hungry people in the world where we've industrialized their agriculture, such as China and India, such as India and places like that. We haven't, China's working in that same direction. But there's no less hungry people there today. When we talk about India moving from a food deficit country to a food export country, we're talking about a country that industrialized its agriculture and it's exporting its food, and it's forced a lot of its subsistence farmers off to the farms and into the ghettos around the urban areas, and we're not feeding them with that kind of system. And the latest UN studies, the last couple that have been done, they pulled together people that really look closely at this and say the best hope for people in the less developed countries of the world is not genetically modified organisms, industrial agriculture, the Green Revolution. It's to really help people learn how to be more productive on their farms in sustainable ways so that you have a dispersed food system where you move beyond subsistence and begin to trade food in the local communities, and you teach people how to store food so that it's not lost, and you develop it from the ground up, not from the outside in and not from the top down. We have enough resources in the world so that everybody can be well fed, but what we have to do is care about people. And when we do that, then we'll realize that we begin to solve the hunger problem around the world. You know, it may end up as we move to a cheap food policy, or when we move away from a cheap food policy and move toward a sustainable agriculture policy, you know, we may have to change our diets. We may eat less meat. We may eat less calorie-dense foods. But for most of us, you know, that would be an improvement, to move away from the foods that are so calorie dense and to move away from the high fat, high calorie diets. But the most important thing that's going to change, we have to have more farmers, because sustainable agriculture is management intensive. Industrial agriculture is management extensive. We substitute technology and capital for land, for labor and management. But I tell people one of the most challenging occupations I can think of for young people would be to be a farmer. It's more intellectually challenging than about anything I can think of to learn how to go out here and understand how nature works, what's going on in the soil, how to integrate plants and animals and soil, the biological and chemical life of the soil, how to relate to people in local markets, how to care about people and develop personal social relationships. Those are the keys to the future, but it's going to take more people. So the next thing is how are we going to get more young people to choose farming as an occupation? Well, I can tell you one thing. There's a lot of young people that are interested in it, because the last conference before I come here was out in Appleton, Wisconsin. It was Lawrence University. It was organized by students, and it was about choosing farming as an occupation. I thought, well, there'd be a couple of dozen people. I got there over 200 young people from more than a dozen colleges were registered to come in here and talk about farming as an occupation. But in order to do that, we're going to have to change farm policy. We're going to have to change the incentives. We're going to have to change our perception of agriculture as an occupation for the future. And that will change, because agriculture is going to be more and more critical to the future of the country as we move into the future. And we can change agriculture policy. We can change agricultural policy to provide incentives for young people, not just the economic incentives, but the social incentives and the security incentives and things of that nature that it takes to change the direction and occupation choices of young people. And even after we've done that, it may cost a bit more to have a sustainable agriculture, because there's some cost to taking care of the environment, and there's some cost to caring about society. You see, our food in the grocery store isn't nearly as cheap today as we think it is. It's just we're imposing a lot of those ecological costs on people of future generations, and we're imposing a lot of the social costs on people that are in positions they can't protect themselves. They're desperate for work. They work under miserable conditions with little income, with little pay and a few benefits and things of this nature. When we start paying those full costs, it may cost a little bit more initially, but as the cost of fossil energy goes up, we'll find we're at a point in time whenever we are actually producing cheaper. But let's say we made the transition. I figured out if it takes three times as many farmers to farm sustainably, and I know farmers that can produce just as much per acre, and if we change the nature of the system, we can produce even more in sustainable operation. It would probably increase our overall cost of food by somewhere between 6% to 10%. That's all, because we're only working with 20% of the total food cost when we talk about increasing the cost of production at the farm level. And you know what, folks? people would say, well, people will never stand for that. People would never stand for price increases going up that much for food. We've had larger than that in terms of increases in food costs just simply from the ethanol program, the biofuels mandate, which is diverting 40% of the U.S. corn crop, which is a tremendous acreage in terms of not U.S. agriculture production, but global agriculture production, and we're burning it up in our cars. If we can afford the ethanol program, if we can afford a biofuels mandate, we can afford a sustainable agriculture that meets our needs of the current generation without diminishing opportunities for the future. The global UN studies, as I indicated before, indicate that sustainable agriculture is, in fact, the best hope for the poor as we move into the future. You know, one advantage of being old like me is that you can remember when things weren't like they are today. You know, back when I was talking about where I was growing up as a teenager in the 1950s, the farms were small and food systems were local. And it was only until the 1960s when the supermarkets come in. I can remember the first supermarket that come into my part of the country as a Piggly Wiggly. You know, up until then, you took a grocery list down to the grocery store and you give the grocery list to the person behind the counter, and they went back behind the counter into various shelves and places like that, and they took the stuff off the shelf for you and they put it in your bag, and they totaled up the amount and you took your bag of groceries home, or they cut off a piece of meat or whatever it was. That's what I knew when I was growing up. But by the 1960s, the supermarkets were springing up, and I said the interstate highways were built in the late 50s, were beginning to open up things, and so we had the supermarkets begin to replace the mom-and-pop stores, and the little local coffee shops and restaurants began to, in the 1970s, were replaced by the fast food franchises. I can remember the first McDonald's that I ever saw, fast food, you know, hamburgers, 19-cent hamburgers back then. And then the 1990s, we began to see corporations move in and agribusiness began to take over, where the family farms were larger then, but we began to see contract agriculture come in and corporate control in the 90s. And then in the 2000s, we've seen the globalization of the food system with the opening up of the free trade agreements and so on. We've seen this whole transformation from a local, what I would call more sustainable system, to a global industrial system in my adult lifetime. And you know, nobody decreed that. Nobody on high said, well, we've got to change the food system or whatever. It was done one by one. One farmer, one consumer at a time, deciding you're going to grow something different, you're going to buy something different. One voter at a time, if not voting for a change in farm policy, at least assenting to or consenting to the policy changes that were being made without really examining what was going on. One by one, in a period of a little over 50 years, we transformed the whole food system into the food system that we have today. You know, the transformation to it from an industrial to a sustainable food system won't be quick and easy. But you know what? We're not at the mercy of the corporate-dominated market system today or corporate-dominated political system today. If we work together, we can change individually, but if we work together, we still have the political power that we can change farm policies. We can change the policies of our government, but we've got to become active. We've got to become involved in that process as voters, as taxpayers, as well as consumers. And as we change as consumers, and as we change as voters and taxpayers, then we can transform agriculture from industrial to sustainable, and we'll do it one by one. The fundamental purpose of government is to, with respect to agriculture and food, is to provide for food security, to make sure that everyone has a sufficient amount of food to meet their basic physical needs for an active, healthy lifestyle. We need to come to a national consensus that food, good food, is a basic human right, and demand that our government ensure that right by one means or another, and call attention to the fact that what we know for a fact, that just making food cheap is not going to solve that problem. You know, we're living in changing times, as I've tried to describe, and the changes in the next 50 years are going to be at least as great as the last 50 years, and I think even greater. And everything we know from science and everywhere else says that the change will be in the different direction because of the growing environmental and social problems that we're creating by the direction that we're going. And we can change the markets, and we can change our government, and we can change the food system, but it has to be us making individual decisions one by one, even making the decisions to come together collectively one by one, and then acting as a body within the political process. Change is no longer an option. It is an absolute necessity. We can build a fundamentally better food system, and we can build a fundamentally better society, but we'll only do it if we're willing to take the initiative one by one. Thank you. Okay, now it's time for your truth. Whatever you have to say or any questions you want to ask is fine.
Yes, thank you very much. I enjoyed your presentation greatly. I'll just quickly mention, I too was brought up on a dairy farm at the same period as yourself, so I'm very familiar with the process, and I'm a professor here at the university. The question I have, though, is there's something taking place in Africa right now. It's generally called a land grab,
right?
Meaning that, for those of you who don't know much about it, it means that, in essence, the governments of a lot of central governments of a lot of African countries that have good land that isn't being intensively used is now being taken up, and the laws are changed, and people who are on the land are being evicted, et cetera,
right.
And that land is then going to large industrialized processes. Actually, the interesting thing is that there are examples of that now taking place in the United States, where foreign industries are actually moving in and buying up the land.
Right.
So my question of you is, do you have comments on this, and would you like to share your perspectives on it?
Well, there is foreign ownership of land, but outright foreign ownership here I don't think is nearly as the problem that it is elsewhere, and that's primarily because our land is so expensive relative to where it is in other countries. There's a lot of other countries of the world that have much cheaper farmland than we do here. A lot of our farmland here has a lot of residential value built into it, people anticipating development somewhere down the line. And then the other thing is these generous subsidies that I talked about for industrial agriculture has caused land prices just go through the ceiling the past few years at the taxpayer's expense, by the way, so you need to know that. So we're not the prime target area for people taking over land, but there is a realization among some people that the industrial agriculture is dependent on cheap fossil energy, and that the days of cheap fossil energy is over, and it's going to be very important for countries such as China, who's doing a lot of that. If they're going to feed their population in the future, then they say we have to have more land in order to do that. The other thing they do for the countries where they take over the land and change the policy so that they can drive people off the farm is they sell people in other countries on this same basic idea. We're going to come in and industrialize agriculture, and that's going to be good for you. That's going to allow you to develop this industrial society, and you'll have this great wealth and this sort of thing. Well, you know, what we really need to be honest with them is, first of all, it didn't work in this country. The early stages of it was all right because we were in the industrial economy, but it didn't feed the hungry people in this country either. But more important than that, it's even if it had worked for us, it's not going to work in the future because there's not going to be the fossil energy for the fertilizers, the pesticides, the mechanization, and that sort of thing in 50 years. I don't know when we're going to get to the point where it takes more energy to extract the rest of the fossil energy than the energy we get, but somewhere within the next 100 years, certainly, probably within the next 50, we're going to be approaching that point where this industrial agriculture is just not economically sustainable anymore because of the lack of energy. And so that means you're going to have access to more land to produce the same amount of food, unless you transform to a sustainable agriculture. We can actually produce more per acre in a management-intensive, labor-intensive situation than we can with the large-scale industrial system. It just takes more people, and it takes more thoughtful, creative, intelligent people who understand how to work with rebuilding the natural fertility of the soil and working with sophisticated, complex systems of plants and animals and soil all working together. So, you know, they're looking at the industrial model and saying, well, as we run out of energy, then it's going to be a more extensive agriculture. So I think that's what's driving it. I look at other countries and I say, well, I don't know what will work from you, but there's no reason for other countries to make the same mistakes we made here. You know, they at least ought to be making new mistakes rather than the same old ones. Okay. Yes. We got a microphone coming your way.
In southern New Jersey, where we have our farm, there's an extensive movement for preservation. Do you think that preserving farms will help these ideas that you're putting forth for sustainability?
Yeah, ultimately, to have a sustainable agriculture and to feed our current population, our growing population, we've got to come to the realization that land as space is basically a public good. If we leave land totally in the marketplace, we're going to end up with our good agricultural land all covered over with payment. A lot of it's already been covered over with payment, or the basic fertility will be destroyed by commercial development, residential development, and other things. And then when we really need that land to feed people, go back to natural productivity of the land, it won't be there. But that's just one example. What we need is farmland preservation in the sense of saying, okay, this is good farmland. It takes decades, if not centuries, to rebuild naturally productive soil. We've covered that all up with cheap inputs of fertilizers and fuels and this sort of thing. We've covered up the idea that eventually we're going to be relying on the natural productivity of the soil, a complete chemical nutrients, micronutrients, macronutrients, as they would talk about it, biologically active soils, and it takes decades, if not centuries, to rebuild that. So we've got to preserve what's left of that good farmland, not only here but in other parts of the world as well. And what we ought to be doing is we ought to be using what we have left of the fossil energies and the fertilizers and things of that nature to restore the health, to restore the organic matter to the soils where we've depleted the natural productivity of the soil. That's what Professor Albrecht at the University of Missouri, who was head of the soils department in late 1950s when I got there, one of the most respected scientists in the country at that time, was telling us when the new phytogen fertilizers and chemical agriculture come on, he said, you know, we shouldn't go to relying on that for productivity. We should use those things to restore the natural productivity of the soil. And he talked very eloquently about this whole concept is the only way to have healthy plants, healthy animals, and healthy people was to have healthy soils. And he said, when you destroy the natural biological and chemical health of the soil, then you're going to destroy the health of the plants and the animals, and ultimately you destroy the health of the people. He said, when you go to this industrial agriculture, as he would describe it, he says, and let it be driven by economic incentives, you're going to end up with producing large yields of crops, of bulky crops that weigh a lot and therefore are worth a lot in the market. They're going to be very high in calories, and he described that in terms of the carbohydrates and things that come from the air, basically nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen come from the air. He says they're going to be very high in calories, but they're going to be empty of nutrients. He called it go foods, which are high-calorie foods, versus grow foods, which were the foods that are essential for healthy lifestyles, reproduction, the various things that we associate with good health. I think he says the animals and plants and animals are a biochemical photograph of the soil. You look at our society today, you can tell we've got pretty sick soils, right? Look at what we're spending on healthcare, then you look at what we've extracted from the earth. That's the Albrecht hypothesis. As I said, you know, a lot of this stuff, we're dealing with very complex relationships, and unfortunately our current science says, well, unless we can prove this cause and effect relationship, in other words, unless we can isolate the cause and effect so that it fits our current concept of science, then it's all speculation. But folks, we're going to have to recreate science to fit the real world that we live in that's interconnected where it's highly complex. And I'm not saying I have the answers to these things, but I'm saying these are the questions that the great universities ought to be asking rather than continuing to promote a failed system. Yes?
How are you, sir? I was wondering if you could comment on the role that politicians need to play in transitioning away from the agribusiness model that we have now without committing political suicide. Because it seems that without a mandate from voters, where we really have a majority asking for it and demanding it,
the policy options that we talk about.
What's the role of politicians in helping us transition toward a more sustainable?
You're talking about policies, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. What I say is if the general public and the taxpayers actually knew what was going on in the Department of Agriculture and what farm policy was about, they would close down the Department of Agriculture and abolish farm policy tomorrow. that the only thing that keeps the taxpayer passive is this threat. If you don't support these programs, everybody's going to starve to death. If you don't support these programs, food prices are going to go through the ceiling. They didn't tell you that when they told you they were going to put half of the corn crop eventually into ethanol, did they? Well, they knew that what we've done and take half of the U.S. corn crop out is the biggest thing we've ever done to affect food costs in this country from a policy standpoint. If they knew what programs were coming for, what the program dollars were going for, their tax dollars were going for, they wouldn't be supporting it. They think they're supporting family farms, and they think they're supporting a system that's providing safe and healthful food for everyone, and to the extent that it fails to do that, they're told these are just isolated instances, there's really nothing wrong with the system as a whole. You're just being a fanatic out here on the fringe somewhere to be worried about this. You better go home and shut up and thank God that you've got all this bountiful supply of a large quantity of food that you can eat things out of the tropics in the wintertime and all this sort of thing. But they don't tell you to look around at the health of the people and the nutrition and what's in there. So the first thing comes from changing is to realize that what we're doing now isn't working. And then you say, ask a fair question, well, what would you do instead? So whenever I complain about something, then I always have to come up with an alternative policy, whether it would work or not. What I would do would be to take the money that we're spending supporting commodity industrial agriculture today, and I would provide that in the form of a tax credit, not a tax credit that you divert from income, but like what we call the low-income tax credit today. It's negative income tax is what Milton Friedman, one of the most conservative economists around, talked about. But it's something similar to that. We could take what we're spending today, and for every person that counts agriculture as a principal occupation, we could provide like $20,000 and say, if you don't make any money, you get this money from the government to support the transition. But in order to qualify that, you've got to agree to make the transition from an industrial agriculture to a sustainable agriculture. But we'll support you through the rough times. But the difference is that farm income begins to grow. You know, you're making profit, then you pay tax at a higher rate than you were paying before, so that when you reach a level where the farm income is equal to the average income of the population, then you're paying taxes at the same rate that they would pay, and you basically move out of that program. So you would take the same amount of money and provide it as a transition incentive for people to make this transition from a conventional industrial agriculture to a sustainable agriculture. You see, the basic problem in making the transition is that we've so depleted the productivity of the land and our agricultural systems that you go through a period of time when your production does drop, when your yields go down, when you have increased pest pressures, until you rebuild the fertility of the soil, until you have an integrated, diverse system to control the pest. And a lot of people aren't willing to go through that because they don't know if they can survive the transition. Once you get through that transition, and the organic farmers I talked about that their yields are just as high as conventional farmers, they're higher, are people that typically have been farming the same land for 5 to 10 years. They've gone through the transition, they know what works for them on their farm, and they have their cropping system in place, they have their customers that they've developed. So I would use the current farm programs, the allocation we have, to support this transition. We have a program called the Conservation Security or Stewardship Program now. That's a really small program that could provide a prototype for what I'm talking about here. But anyway, that would be my policy proposal if they ask me. I've given it to a few people even if they didn't ask. I'm not likely to get it passed. I'm just trying to plant a few ideas in the minds of people. We can bring about the change. That's what my book, A Revolution in the Middle, is about. We just need to get together and reestablish a consensus for change. And then, you know, we still live in a democracy. And even if we didn't, we could do like the Russians or Chinese or whatever. You can change your government if you decide you want to do it. Yes, next question. Have one over here. That's fine. We have one down here as a new one, and then we have the lady that asked the question before.
Thanks, Dr. I was wondering if, obviously, in the second half of your academic career you probably rubbed shoulders with a few people in your transition to your new principles. I was just wondering if you took away any lessons from that process that we might apply toward bringing change about generally in the country.
Right. Well, I can tell you in the academic institutions, most of the academic institutions are not nearly as tolerant of diversity of ideas as they claim to be. If you come up with ideas that are truly different, I don't care how well-founded your ideas are in basically common sense or fact or even in statistics and history. Sort of industrial paradigm and this mechanistic way of thinking is deeply entrenched within our academic institutions. And it's also deeply entrenched within society. But in many cases, I think society is more willing to change. Farmers are more willing to change. What I say makes more sense to average consumers and average people than it does to most people either in agricultural industry or in the academic institutions. And why is that? Because they haven't been so thoroughly indoctrinated into this view of the world as this mechanistic thing that we're apart from, that's set here for us to use and that we can manipulate somehow. You know, it's a lot of questions about genetically modified organisms and things of that nature. I've had some good discussions here, and I'm always like to engage in that. But as I look at that, that's just a new technology that's being used within the old paradigm, the old way of thinking. It's another way that we think that we're going to conquer nature. Every time we think we're going to conquer nature, nature always comes back. Nature has the last word in the arguments. And so we could be using the same molecular biology to understand how nature works so that we don't fight nature nearly so much in trying to meet our individual needs. I think the common farmer, particularly the farmer, anybody that's working on the land, and most people in just the basic middle of life, realize that. It's common sense. That's the reason I stress common sense. A lot of what I'm talking about is just common sense. When I talk about the opportunity to create a fundamentally better world, I'm talking about common sense. We all know that we as people have material, physical needs that need to be met. That's what the economy is about. Economic value is inherently individual. It's instrumental, always an expectation of getting something back. And it's impersonal. It's not connected to one person. You have to be able to trade something and have economic value. That's how we meet our material, physical needs, and that's important. But we're also social beings. We know that. We know that beyond some minimal level of meeting our material needs, that the quality of our life is far more dependent upon the quality of our relationships with other people, within families, within communities, friendship. That's what determines whether or not we're happy and whether we feel good about ourselves and where we feel good about life. Those are purely personal relationships, the personal connectedness. That's not economics. But we know that we're social beings and we need to develop those relationships, and if we spent more time developing those, our lives would be better. And we're also ethical, moral beings. We need a sense of rightness and goodness about what we're doing. And whenever we compromise our social relationships, the quality of those relationships, or whenever we compromise our ethical and moral senses or values in the pursuit of our individual economic self-interest, we diminish our quality of life. We don't enhance it. So I think most people understand that we would be a better society, that we'd be happier, better satisfied, probably healthier, if we spent more time on relationships, more time in doing things that we truly believe are right and good. See, that doesn't make any sense in an academic community because you can't prove that scientifically. As far as science is concerned, there is no purpose to life. It's just the evolution of these chemical impulses and biological processes and electronic impulses and things like this. But most people understand that life has purpose, that it has meaning, that it matters how you treat other people, that we need to love and be loved, and we need to care and be cared for. And that part of that responsibility is to take care of the earth. We have a responsibility to those people of the future to those people of the past that we can only repay to those people of the future. That makes sense to a lot of people. So that's where my hope is. It's a rise of the common sense of the common people. Take control of the government, take control of their academic institutions, and put us back on the right track. Yes, we have another question.
One last question.
I think it's really important to say this, even though people are getting ready to go. The powers that be of our food industry have convinced us that animal fat is detrimental to our health, and high cholesterol is something to be feared. And so the dairy products, the dairy industry is faltering, the dairy right. farmers, the milk prices, and when we wake up and realize how much we need animal products, right. we need healthy cows and healthy dairy products, red meat, to right. To a sensible extent, we won't have the farms and the farmers to provide them for us. Right.
Well, my sense is kind of a common sense that we need a good, healthful, balanced diet. I refer to something as a diet as kind of a sensible diet. It's whatever you sense that your body needs is probably something that's good for you. And whenever you get wrapped up with too much of any one thing is probably going to be bad for you. That's the reason all these diets that focus on just one thing and generally don't really work. But, I mean, that's up to that's what the nutritionists and the people in the food science, the health science, those are questions that people ought to be asking. My problem or my kind of gripe with the health industry, the diet industry, and academic institutions that are studying it is, in too many cases, they aren't willing to ask the questions that are uncomfortable for the food industry. They aren't really willing to explore this idea that we're basically taking the nutrient value out of the raw materials from which we're processing the food. They will ask questions about fast food and lifestyle and things like that, things that blame basically the problems on the people and not on the industry as a whole, because there's great risk in challenging the food industry. There's great risk in challenging the conventional wisdom about what good food is and what it isn't. There's great risk in challenging the propaganda that comes out of the corporate food system. And so a lot of people in academic institutions, I'm not accusing anybody here because I have no idea, you know, really what you're doing. I just know a lot of people in the land-grant universities, the agricultural colleges, the people that are in diet and nutrition there, you know, they put their careers at risk whenever they challenge the conventional wisdom of the food system. We need to come beyond that. And I'll end is kind of where we started. We're at a point in time when we need to be willing to rethink how the world works and where we fit within it. We need to be willing to rethink the very foundational principles of science and to rethink the whole industrial paradigm as to whether it's right or wrong. And I always tell my former colleagues within institutions, and I'll tell you here, that people in academic institutions are paid far too much money to simply be those that are the promoters of some sort of technological kind of fix to whatever we're doing. The people in these institutions are the ones that have the responsibility to think about how the world works, to examine all of the ideas, to encourage their students to think openly, and to challenge the conventional wisdom continually. If you don't do it, then who's going to do it? I'll tell you who's eventually going to do it. It's going to be the young people out here that know that there's something fundamentally wrong. They know this society isn't working, and they're looking to you for help, for them to figure out how the world really works and how they really fit within it so that they can move forward and create a fundamentally better world for themselves and their children than the one that they grew up in. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here tonight. Thank you.
I'll just ask everyone if you'd like to join us afterwards to continue the conversation outside and enjoy the reception. Thank you very much.